You are now listening to a podcast made in collaboration with the Copenhagen College Radio.
Hi, and thanks for tuning in to episode 18 of the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, political scientist at the University of Copenhagen. Make sure you're subscribed on iTunes to get all our latest episodes when they drop. And remember that you can follow us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast and on Facebook, facebook.com/socialmediaandpoliticspodcast. In this week's episode, we're going to cover something that I'm personally super interested in, which is dark social networks. What do I mean when I say a dark social network? Well, maybe it's not the best term to describe these platforms. We really don't have another name for them. I've heard of them also referred to as mobile instant messaging services. And to kind of illustrate the types of networks I'm talking about, I kind of just pulled a non-exhaustive list of all these types of social media that they really lack a public broadcasting feature. So when we think about Facebook and Twitter, the kind of way they're built is to be a public forum. For Facebook, that's more constrained to your friend network. On Twitter, it's a bit more open. You can connect with celebrities, etc. But dark social networks are those that lack this broadcasting feature. They're typically natively mobile or used predominantly through a mobile device. They're very focused on messaging, usually direct messaging, typically among close friends. And the type of communication that takes place in these more closed networks are more personal, more private, maybe focused around an interest that is deeply shared by a group of individuals. And for that reason, we can think that dark social networks might reflect or foster a tighter sense of community or more close-knit, honest relationships. So what kind of platforms am I talking about? I mean, I think when we're thinking about these dark social networks, WhatsApp is king. WhatsApp currently has 1.2 billion users, so there's a good chance that you're on WhatsApp. And if you are, you know what I'm talking about. There isn't this mass broadcasting feature, this news feed, and those who you communicate with on WhatsApp are probably closer to you than many of your Facebook friends. Some other examples you might think of are Snapchat, Viber, which is similar to Skype, but also has this messaging feature. There's a platform called Line in Japan. There's also Slack, which is for collaborating between working teams on projects. You have Wickr, which is a very kind of secretive messaging platform that's encrypted with self-destructing messages. We could also consider Telegram, which has been used previously to carry out terrorist attacks. Yik Yak, which creates forums for conversations based on location. There's also one called Hive, which is specifically aimed at college campuses. There's also dating apps like Tinder, Bumble, Hinge, Happn that all have private communication that isn't publicly broadcast. Generally takes place on a mobile phone, is focused on direct messaging, is typically among close friends or potential close friends, and reflects a sort of personal, private form of communication that isn't meant for everyone to see. And because of that, at least in the academic literature, we know virtually nothing about how these platforms are affecting political processes. I mean, we know that activists and political party supporters might use WhatsApp or they might communicate on Snapchat. But because of the lack of access to data, we actually can't produce any hard science on what's going on in these networks outside of focus groups and interviews. And this is problematic for a number of reasons, not just because we don't know how the types of communication taking place in these platforms is affecting political preferences or political participation, but also because of just the massive number of people who are on these platforms. So as I mentioned, WhatsApp has over 1 billion monthly users. Snapchat clocks in over 300. WeChat, popular in China, has almost a billion. Line in Japan, 200 million. Snow, the Asian version of Snapchat, has 40 to 50 million. I mean, there's lots of people on these platforms, and we don't know what they're talking about. How are they discussing politics, and what effect is it having, if any, on the political volatility that we see in a host of countries across the globe? So I wanted to learn more about these dark social networks, and to do that, I reached into the field of marketing. My guest today is Paul Hurley, a digital content and marketing expert who, together with John Salmon, founded Frictionless Social, a marketing firm connecting companies with users in dark social networks. Paul and John also host a podcast called The Dark Social Marketing Podcast, where they discuss the challenges and opportunities that dark social poses for organizations and brands. You can find The Dark Social Marketing Podcast on iTunes and learn more about Frictionless Social by checking out their website, www.frictionless.social. Skyping in from London, Paul, thanks for taking the time out and welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for inviting me and very pleased to be here.
So let's start right at the beginning here. What exactly is dark social?
Well, I guess there's two ways you could approach that. One would be a little bit more technical, and that's in fact the original way it was looked at. The phrase was coined in 2012 in an article in The Atlantic magazine, and it was coined to denote any traffic or tracking that wasn't coming from the traditional open pillars of social sharing. So stuff that wasn't coming from Facebook and Twitter, etc. And as they drilled down a little bit more, they realized that this was coming from dark social platforms, and in particular, messenger platforms such as WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger. We can discuss later how there's a kind of world territorial land grab of different messengers in different countries and regions. But the second part is how we have come into it. And what we're interested in is penetrating this world of dark social, which is, again, the WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, WeChat, and trying to connect organizations, entities, brands with users and customers in there who want to be connected to these organizations and brands. So essentially, it's sharing privately. Most people have probably got some form of WhatsApp group in the UK or Kik group in the States or Line in Japan. And those groups might consist of, typically, it might be a small family group, it might be a friends group, it might be a common interest group, it might be a group who are planning an event such as a wedding or a sports fans group. So it's sharing in this area. The term dark social isn't something we're particularly keen on because it has this kind of slight similarity, although it's completely different from the dark web.
Right.
So in fact, we've been talking to people more and more about it as hidden social.
Mm-hmm. I think what you allude to is that it's a lot about messaging and a lot about communities. And you've talked a little bit about Kik, WhatsApp, but can you kind of give us a, not necessarily exhaustive list, but some examples of what might be considered dark or hidden social?
Yeah, well, if you went to China, anyone who's been to China may have noticed that the predominant means of messaging there is WeChat. And you could do so many things on WeChat, not just chatting to your little distinct groups, but you can book all of your healthcare and pay for your healthcare on there. You can make doctor's appointments. You could pay parking fines, etc. So in China, WeChat really is the dominant player. In the West, so probably talking about the States and North America and mainland Europe, it's Facebook Messenger and WhatsApp. You've got also Kik, which is doing very well amongst younger people in the States, and you've got Line in Japan. There are different regional players, as there are different regional websites. And there are lots more that I haven't mentioned, but those are the kind of core ones that people will know.
And what sort of sets these platforms apart from, I guess, the more broadcast-oriented platforms like Twitter or Facebook? That's very much one-to-many communication.
Yeah, now we're getting into the nitty-gritty of why this is important. And one of the main things that sets them apart is the way people are acting in these messenger platforms. They are acting completely differently to the way in which they are acting on open platforms such as Twitter or Facebook. We, just to give you a little bit of background, we noticed about a year ago, myself and John came from a video background. So we've been creating viral content for major media players in the UK for a number of years. And we noticed about a year ago that these sharing statistics or the tracking statistics were changing enormously, that they were coming from places like WhatsApp, etc. And we decided to do our own research into that by conducting focus groups and surveys and finding people and organizing all sorts of activities within WhatsApp in the last half of last year to see if there was a proof of concept. And we discovered a number of things, one of them being the answer to your question about what sets dark social apart. And it really is down to the way people act, the way people receive stuff, the way people are more honest, and the way people are more receptive. So just to break those down a little bit, the way people act on Facebook or Twitter now, there is a desire or a need to act in a certain way. You're putting up a version of you. Certainly that could be the case on Facebook, and certainly that could be the case on Instagram. So it's a little bit of a cliche, but it's showing how you have the perfect life with your perfect family and putting on a kind of impression of you.
Right. And I think there's a sense of social risk there as well.
Correct.
That maybe wasn't, I mean, as someone who sort of started with Facebook in high school, I've definitely noticed changes in both how myself and others that I know post. And I think it does have a lot to do with you're really putting yourself out there, and therefore you kind of want to project a certain, as you said, an image or have some sort of self-promotion goal behind it.
And then if you take it one step further and take it into politics, if we look at what's happened in the UK in the middle of last year with Brexit, and if we look at what's happened in the US, I don't live in the US since the election in November, I can imagine that people are approaching Facebook in a very, very different way. Prior to Brexit, I can tell you that is all people talked about, you know, a lot on Facebook, and it became quite heated, the arguments. Post Brexit and post the vote to leave the EU, there was a lot of increasingly vindictive behavior, a lot of, I told you, so there wasn't really much rational or intellectual debate. That's kind of gone on and petered out a tiny little bit. There are diehards who are still sort of protesting about the result one way or the other. But it's been interesting that that has happened on Facebook, and you have all this kind of echo chamber stuff, which has been well chronicled over the last year, etc. So on Facebook, you have this kind of, I need to act in a certain way, and the political thing is getting a little bit too much. On Twitter, there's so much noise on Twitter. Twitter's got an increasingly negative reputation because of trolling. And also, is anyone actually listening to me? If you're an average person, well, how many people are actually listening to you? They have to be there at the exact time that your statement appears in their feed. So people are kind of moving away. It's kind of plateauing out on Twitter. And because of that, in dark social, people can act in a much more natural way. Because they know the people involved, they're just able to relax. They don't have to put any, you know, sort of third party impression on. The second thing then is because of that, they are a lot more honest. They are themselves. And I think that kind of blends into my third point about being a lot more natural. And then the final thing is that they are a lot more receptive. So if you share something with me on WhatsApp, I am highly, highly likely to open it. If it's something that's just been shared on Twitter, on Facebook, much less likely. But if you share something personally, the word of mouth recommendation value on WhatsApp is enormous.
Yeah. And do you want to talk a little bit about the research that you've done? From what I was looking at on your website and through the report that you can get through signing up to your newsletter, it was a cross-country comparison, right? This isn't specific to just the UK or just the US.
Yeah, we've done various different surveys, which you can read about. We've done, you know, with WeChat, there's an instant translation service there. So you can do a multilingual pop-up chat on there quite easily. And we did that around the time of Brexit to see what the people around the world thought of whether Britain should remain in the EU or not. Then at the time of the presidential election, the weekend before it, we did a survey on Yik Yak, which is a platform I haven't mentioned, a little bit maligned, but still has a life out there.
Sorry to interrupt. I remember seeing it on your on your website, but now I'm actually just remembering what Yik Yak is. Is it Yik Yak is a platform where people can post based on location, right? Kind of anonymously and...
Yeah, anonymously based on location, exactly. And it became popular, it became a kind of slightly faddish thing maybe 2 or 3 years ago in American high schools and universities.
Yes, exactly.
Then it kind of got maligned a bit because people were saying, oh, they're using it for sexting or for the wrong type of... you know, that there could be vitriolic abuse going on there, that it was like, you know, not really being reined in properly. However, it does still have a little bit of a life. And at the time when we did this survey in London, actually, it was surprising that people were really, A, ready to engage on it. Most of the people we assume on there, because of what they've told us, are between 16 to 25. And we did this little survey just in the week leading up to the election, and most young Londoners felt that Trump was going to win it. And even if you followed it closely, up until the day before the election, you had like 538 predicting that Hillary was going to win it, the 90% chance. It was only on the day that that graph started changing. So I'm not saying ours was as scientific as theirs, because we certainly didn't have as many people involved, but it gave an indication that this could be done, that you could find out this kind of information. What are people really thinking? Because in this place, they are more themselves.
Yeah, and it brings me to a point I wanted to ask you about, which is, I think by now, people are quite aware that when they're communicating on Facebook or Twitter, that they're giving away data, essentially. That data is being collected and being, you know, appropriated for a number of purposes. And I think the perception behind some of these darker, hidden social networks is that the conversations are more private. Like, many of the apps have encryption, I believe, like Wickr, and I think also WhatsApp is encrypted. So my question is, what's actually going on these platforms in terms of data collection? Like, what's in it for the providers themselves?
Right now, it's only a very basic level of data collection, which is that you can track that people have shared your link or clicked through on your link from WhatsApp or from Facebook Messenger. But you can't find out anything more than that from a technical point of view. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty basic right now. What we are trying to do is get into this space and talk to these people so that we can find out what they are thinking or what they would like vis-a-vis whatever the subject is. Because, of course, we've already dealt with projects and are dealing with projects which aren't just political. We've got things in health, we've got things in sport, we've got things in entertainment, etc. And if you can find the right people, it's that classic marketing thing, finding the right people with the right offer at the right time and going into these groups, creating these groups and going into them, they will give you a lot more feedback. And they are prepared to give honest feedback about what a new product or a new film or whatever it is. And when we do our little groups, I'll tell you a little bit more about how we might manage groups or how we create groups later if you want. When we create our groups, we usually most of the time finish up with a little poll or a survey for them to fill out. And the fill out rate on that is generally pretty high. And that is kind of like, you know, quite a lot of customer engagement there, feeding back to the client about what they've liked or what they didn't like or what they would like going forward about the particular event that we've staged.
Mm-hmm. And that's from a marketing perspective, right?
I think it's from a marketing, it's from a relevance, it's from an overall... what are people thinking point of view. Yes, it is from a marketing perspective, but I think there's a little bit more to it. And the thing that I always think is, you touched on it, saying that Facebook and WhatsApp are encrypted end-to-end. But if you're Facebook, who owns WhatsApp, you've basically got a sort of tap to the world's brain.
Right.
If you could de-encrypt or unencrypt these messages, you could see what everybody is talking about. It's extraordinary.
Exactly, which brings me directly to my next question, which is, what's the value in these types of networks for politicians or for NGOs? What value does that have for a political purpose?
Well, let's imagine you were running an election campaign and you could run a number of different groups in the constituency which was full of advocates. It's not a formal meeting, so it doesn't have to happen at a certain time of the day. People don't have to be in the same place at the same time. People can be in different parts of the constituency. You can share relevant information for them that they can then go out and use in the real world or on their open social platforms. I think for political campaigns going forward, it's going to be really quite big. It's almost an extension of what Trump did with Facebook groups. I don't know if you've read much about that. It's really interesting what he did with Facebook groups in the lead.
Could you go into that?
Yeah, in the lead up to his victory. So from my reading, Trump employed a guy by the name of Brad Parscale out of, I think he's based in Texas. He has his own company. And they were doing all of the Facebook marketing and targeting. And they decided to really create a number of groups on Facebook. And they were feeding those groups certain information. And these groups, there were about 13 million voters, and they were people who were registered Republicans but hadn't voted Republican in the last 10 years. And they thought if they can, you know, provoke, let's say 60, 70% of those people to get out and vote in certain key swing states, then we've got a good chance here. So they might have a very, very regional, very, very local group about supporting Trump in one part of America. They're providing that group with certain information, certain, whether they be images, GIFs or videos, whatever it is, political information that these people were taking on board to persuade them to vote for Trump, and then to be able to go out and use that as part of their arguments with their friends, etc. And you can do exactly the same or more in WhatsApp because of the fact that people are in this receptive state or whatever messenger service you're using. So it's a way of creating advocates, super fans, influencers from a political point of view that can then go out and spread the word and come back in and have this kind of united little political family during the course of the campaign.
And it sounds quite cost effective or organic. Maybe you have to recruit some members to this group by paid advertising. But I mean, having a WhatsApp group or having a Facebook group, once you have them in this community, it's relatively cost effective, I think, for a campaign to mobilize them.
Yeah. We typically get our people for our groups either from the client themselves, so they might provide us with a list of interested parties, or we can recruit them. We would typically recruit them on the open web from Twitter or Facebook. But the cost effectiveness is that once you've started one group and you have like a schedule of activities for them during the week, you can replicate that quite easily. So you can mirror that and just have 10 groups who are kind of doing the same thing. The group size is very important for this. With WhatsApp, I think you can go up to 250 or 256. We certainly don't like to go up much past 100. I mean, my ideal number for a group is really 20 to 25, because then you feel like you're having a conversation that you're taking part in. Mm. Otherwise, you go back to what I said earlier about being lost in a Twitter world where there's just a couple of really shouty people in the room.
Yeah, I think in one of our last episodes on the Dutch elections, our guest, Dr. Christoph Jacobs, was saying how Dutch political parties did exactly that. They had these groups of activists, essentially, or hardcore supporters that they would mobilize and say, hey, now spread this message or use these hashtags and sort of coordinate action. But yeah, I think if the group gets too big, then you kind of go into the kind of mainstream social network dynamics like Facebook and Twitter, where you're kind of you're more of an observer than a participant.
Exactly, which is what we don't want. Yeah,
right. And so one of the things I think is interesting is that when I'm going onto social media to promote the podcast and I type in social media and politics as keywords, the large majority of the tweets are about stop talking about politics on social media. Keep it a safe space for entertainment or what have you. And so I'm wondering what that means in terms of the private networks on dark social or hidden social. I think one of the things about it is you're more in control of the topics that you want to engage with or the people you want to engage with. And so let's say you're a political campaign and you're trying to create these groups. Do you think people might be put off by political conversations in dark social, as it's seen as a kind of safe space to control exactly the topics you want to talk about? And if you don't want to engage with politics, maybe that might have an adverse effect for politicians who really try to tap into these networks.
Well, it's a good question. And I'd be interested in your opinion as well, because what are you seeing it seems to me there's been a massive increase in the amount of people talking about politics in the last 18 months to 2 years because of, in the Western world, because of Brexit and because of Trump. All I see when I go onto Facebook or Twitter is, so much political debate. Now, that could be because of the people I'm following or the people I'm friends with. I kind of hear what you're saying about people saying don't talk about politics. But I think there are a lot of people who are really engaged and really interested in what the hell's going on in the world right now. And this is giving them very easy. It's something, you're carrying your phone around in your pocket. You don't have to be anywhere at any particular time. It's just there. And it's a much easier way to engage. And it can be, if you want to go as far as being an activist, it can be with like-minded people who might be of the same political persuasion or party, etc. And you could help out. I mean, what it's interesting you say that about people saying, don't talk about politics, because I see a lot more political discussion than I've ever seen.
Absolutely. And I think, one of the reasons is that the elections, both in terms of the Brexit referendum and also in the U.S., have been very newsworthy. Social media, especially Twitter, right, is a site for news. And so one of the things that I think political scientists are interested in is what is the democratic potential of these media? And you touched upon echo chambers. I think I don't know whether danger is the right word, but I totally agree that people should be able to discuss politics, online. The question is whether the certain dynamics of a hidden social network really reinforce that echo chamber. Can you imagine a WhatsApp group where people are really debating politics? Because it seems to be more for people of a certain political alignment that want to engage with each other.
Yeah, that's certainly a fair point. And that's why I think a primary use for it in political campaigns will be that, creating those groups and capturing those groups. Whether or not they'll want to have the kind of fiery debates that they have on the open platforms where people can be slinging a lot of insults back and forth, I'd probably say they wouldn't, because they want this space to be, you know what, it's like a calmer space. It's like a place where they are more relaxed, and now I'm going onto Twitter and Facebook, it's like I've got to put my armor on almost, because I don't know what I'm going to get on there right now. Whereas in here, in the dark spaces, they are more relaxed and probably don't want that antagonism. So I think that is a really good point, actually. Yeah.
And it will be difficult to monitor if we can't get the data, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk about, I think one of the things that you're doing at Frictionless is trying to see how organizations can get into these social networks. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So
absolutely, yeah.
And one of the ways, or one of the immediate ways that I think of by doing that is through chatbots. Could you talk a little bit about chatbots? And do you have any idea about political uses for those?
Yeah, I can see the two main issues with chatbots. One is that we have to get to a place where chatbots can really employ this thing called NLU, natural language understanding, when a chatbot can really converse with you. Because weirdly now, some of the chatbots that are already out there are half AI and half human. Some of the functionality that's going on behind the scenes is a human responding.
Mm-hmm.
So I think chatbots still have a little bit of a way to go from a technical point of view. And then from a commercial point of view, well, if we could all name a chatbot that had overtaken the world or our country and that we were all obsessed with, we can't do that. No chatbot has broken through yet. And I think there is an awful lot of potential there. It may be to do with the delay in NLU. Right now, from a political point of view, they can be used, but I think it would probably be used in a feed or a prompt type way. So if you employed a chatbot, it could remind people to go and vote, or could remind people to pick up their neighbor that they were going to go and help them to vote. It would be like an organizer from a political point of view right now. We're not certainly not saying the jury is out, but I think we still have to wait until that killer, it's like, what's the killer app? What's the killer chat? Mm-hmm. But it hasn't necessarily arrived yet.
And are those relatively cheap to program, or?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes, they can start from a very cheap, for a kind of function-led one, which I was kind of describing to you there, that would be the cheapest kind of chatbot you could have, and that would come in less than four figures in dollars for sure.
Mm-hmm.
From a basic point of view, yeah.
Interesting. We had an episode not too long ago on bots and how easy they were to program. So I'm wondering if somehow chatbots could be not necessarily hijacked, but inserted into conversations. If there has to be some sort of control from the providers, I think, in order to make these really effective and not really manipulating conversation.
Yeah, yeah. And as soon as people start to realize that it's getting a bit limited or it's a bit false, then problems start to arise.
Exactly.
I think with them. Yeah. So there's a little bit of a way to go. Yeah.
So let's do a little plug for the Dark Social Marketing podcast, which I think is great.
Thank you.
And kind of hits these apps from different angles. So you have an episode on politics, but also more generally in marketing. And on the latest episode, I just wanted to pick up on one of the topics, which was discussing Mark Zuckerberg's quote-unquote manifesto, or sort of letter he put out, kind of writing his global vision for Facebook. And you were talking a lot about the emphasis that he was placing on communities. Can you discuss that a bit here and how communities factor into hidden social networks?
I thought it was a real standout takeaway from the piece that Zuckerberg wrote. And in my own experience, I'd go so far as to say that in the last couple of years, communities have almost saved Facebook or kept it at the top of the front of mind for people, because most people now are involved in some sort of private group or community on Facebook. And those things are likely to be very pertinent to you, often quite local, often quite transitory. So there's a famous case of one about it snowing in a very warm place in the States, might have been Atlanta. There's a pop-up group that appears every time that happens. It could be fitness related, it could be health related, it could be business related. These communities have become massively prolific on Facebook in the last 18 months. And that's why he was keen to hop on board with them, amongst his other rhetoric about Facebook being a safe place and a way in which we can all communicate easily. Part of that is communities, and the natural segue from communities is into these smaller hidden social groups.
Mm-hmm. And if we think about communities in the context of politics or society, we touched upon it a little bit, but I want to ask you about the democratic potential, or what dark social or hidden social means for democracy. It's increasingly where younger users are headed. Data shows that, especially between 16 and 25, as you said, heading towards these apps, especially on their mobile devices. Is this a good or bad thing for democracy, the conversations that are taking place here?
Well, if it's encouraging people to have conversations, and if it's possibly helping to give people a right steer, then it must be seen as a good thing. So within the Zuckerberg manifesto, for instance, he talks about a Kenyan village where the whole of the community communicates and decides upon, makes their decisions on what to do via WhatsApp. You've got written reports, which you can look up, of the CIA educating and using WhatsApp in IS-controlled or IS-potentially controlled areas of the world in order to combat that by creating groups and trying to send them information which the CIA want them to see, which would be obviously anti-IS stuff. And of course, terrorism reared its head again at the weekend. There was an attack in London last week, and the Home Secretary of the UK was all over the television talking about how the likes of Facebook Messenger and WhatsApp must lose their end-to-end encryption because governments want to be able to see what people are seeing or see what people are saying in there.
Right.
I don't think that's going to happen, because once in the UK, once people know that they are being snooped upon by the government, then they'll just give up the ghost and go to a different chat messenger. And then, of course, in different countries, it's very different. In China, WeChat is observed by the government, and everyone knows that, and everyone carries on their normal daily lives and their communication on there with the knowledge that the government is able to access what they are saying.
Yeah, which is an interesting dynamic that, let's say, for example, that the EU would step in and have a similar type of regulation. People will still continue to use these networks because of the things you mentioned before, the honesty, the sort of being in control of who you're speaking with.
Exactly.
So it's a very new issue, and something that I think we're still trying to figure out, both us as observers, but also the companies themselves, as to how exactly to navigate regulation and how to effectively use these platforms.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, which is why we have set out our stall to kind of educate. Educate is the first port of call for us, to let people know what they're about, that it's not dark web, that it's a little bit more than just having a little WhatsApp group with your friends. And then we are creating campaigns for these companies or organizations, and then maintaining these campaigns. And politics is definitely like a boom area for this.
Yeah, and it's something that I also notice in the field of political communication and social media, that people are starting to turn their attention to these platforms. This is where also people are moving. So yeah. Very interesting stuff, Paul. Thanks so much for taking the time out, and
you're welcome.
I'll be following your work closely.
Thank you, Michael. It was great to speak to you.
I've just been speaking with Paul Hurley, a digital content marketing expert who, together with John Salmon, founded Frictionless Social, a marketing firm connecting companies with users in dark social networks. To find out more about Frictionless, you can visit their website, www.frictionless.social, and check out the Dark Social Marketing podcast, hosted by Paul and John. That's it for this week's episode of the Social Media and Politics Podcast. I hope you didn't find dark social too spooky, and make sure to tune in again next week, where we're going to be talking about world leaders on Instagram. Subscribe on iTunes to make sure you catch that when it drops. And in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast and on Facebook. Just type in Social Media and Politics Podcast in the search box. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, signing off from Copenhagen. See you next time.